To Dan off mic, COVID-19 continues to climb in Indiana and in Northwest Indiana. The city of East Chicago, with its large Latino population, is leading the way. We talked to one East Chicago couple who battled COVID-19 and won. We also talked to the head of the city's health department on why EC's rate for the virus is so high. We talked to a local author of a book about the long-lost history of Hammond. And will Major League Baseball be able to finish out their 60-game season? All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I am Michael Puente, Northwest Indiana Bureau reporter for WBEZ. Indiana's mask mandate went into effect this week. It's to try to keep that COVID-19 rate down. It's been going through the roof as of late. In last week's show, I brought you the firsthand account of a woman from East Chicago who had battled COVID-19. Today, I want to bring you a conversation with two other East Chicago residents who are also recovering from COVID-19. I've been focusing on East Chicago because as of now, it has the highest COVID-19 rate of any city in Northwest Indiana and one of the highest in the state of Indiana. Here is the interview with Jose and Melinda Gutierrez of East Chicago. My first question to Jose is, what does he do for a living?
Well, I worked for the city of East Chicago for 36 years, and then I retired. Got a job at Sam's Club working overnights for a little while, and then applied for U.S. Steel and got hired at U.S. Steel.
Had you ever been kind of sick like this before at all?
Like this? No, I've never been this sick, no.
Do you have any underlying health conditions before this happened?
Well, before this happened, yeah, I'm like a borderline diabetic, and I do have a little high blood pressure, yeah.
And when all this started to happen, did they tell you people who had maybe, I'm not going to call your immune system compromised, but people with underlying conditions that they may be more susceptible to getting this virus?
Oh, yeah. And then granted that I'm 58 years old, I mean, that's kind of a issue there, too. You know, the older people and people with underlying issues have a tendency of catching this disease.
Now, let me ask you this. Did you take any of the warnings seriously, or were you more like, it's not going to get me?
At first I was, yeah. I didn't really take it very serious until I, you know, started getting the symptoms, and then I took it serious, but day late and a dollar short there.
And before you got sick, were you wearing a mask, or nothing like that?
Before I got sick? No, I wasn't wearing a mask or anything like that. No.
And were you like having to work close, surrounded by people?
Well, when I got sick, I wasn't working for the city. I retired a couple years ago.
Oh, and, I see. Okay.
My wife works for the city now. Yeah.
You were working at Sam's Club?
No, I was working at U.S. Steel.
Oh, U.S. Steel. Okay. All right. What do you do at U.S. Steel?
I'm a laborer.
Labor. And at the time, they weren't requiring the use of masks or talking about social distancing.
Yeah, U.S. Steel had, they have the safety issue where you have to wear a mask if you're within 6 feet of anybody. But I normally wear a face shield since I work with a lot of scrap, so that works just as good.
And that was before the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, I've been, since I work around scrap, I'm required to wear a face shield all the time anyway, so.
I see. All right. So tell me, when did you start getting sick, and do you have any idea as to where or how you may have contracted it?
I believe I may have caught it from my wife because she was training somebody on a how to operate a dump truck, and I guess he had it. She caught it from him, and then she brought it home and gave it to me.
All right. And what were some of the, I mean, did you get sick like right away, or was this, did it come on kind of slowly?
She got sick first. And then like a day later is when I started getting migraine headaches and body aches and chest congestion and all that. Yeah.
And how soon after that did you end up saying, I better get to the hospital? Or did you even think you may have had it and had to go get tested?
Well, I went to work. And then first, as a matter of fact, it was April Fool's Day. And I didn't last maybe 2.5 hours there, and I couldn't breathe. So I punched out. I clocked out. I went to the doctor the next day. He gave me checks, x-rays. Checked me out, gave me x-rays. Come back, told me I had a pneumonia. He told me to go get checked for COVID. So I went that same day, got tested, and come back. The results come back the next day, and I was positive.
On the 3rd of April.
So then what did you do after that? Go stay at the hospital or stay at home at that time?
I tried to wait one day, try to see if it would go away, and it just actually got worse. So then I just went and checked myself in St. Catherine's Hospital.
Saturday before.
Well, how was that process like? Were you scared?
No, definitely, yeah. Just walking into the emergency room, I felt lightheaded. My oxygen level was like at 70 something. So, I mean, I felt like I was going to pass out just walking in there.
Did anybody go with you?
Yeah, my wife went with
me. They kicked me out.
But they told her to leave. And then they put me like in a separate emergency room. It was like a COVID wing. They had split the emergency room in half, and they put me on a bed, and after that was it. They pumped oxygen in me, try to get my oxygen levels back up.
And so when we first got there, I told them, when we went in the ER, I said, he's positive for COVID, so we're not going to sit down. They said, okay, well, you got to go out that door, sir, go to the right and go in the very next door, and you got to leave. They never even let me in the hospital.
Yeah, they don't let people in the hospital now either.
Yeah, I wasn't able to see him the whole time he was admitted. So.
Were you upset about that, or did you kind of understand it now?
Oh, I wasn't upset about it. I knew that they weren't going to let nobody up there no way. And being I got asthma, they really wouldn't have, since they kicked me out. As long as they took care of him is all that mattered to me.
So what kind of care did you receive, and how long were you in the hospital for?
I was in the hospital 10 days, and they had me on oxygen. Like I said, they had me on 15 liters of oxygen, and they couldn't stabilize it at first. It was up and down from between 14 to 15. And they told me if it would have got any worse, they'd have to intubate me and then put me on a ventilator.
And you had concerns about that.
Yeah, I didn't want them knocking me out. And you know what I mean? After that, you don't know what may happen.
So when did you start feeling a little better?
After about the fourth day, between the third and fourth day, then I started to stabilize. And then they were telling me that my oxygen level was, I didn't need that many liters of oxygen. It was going like from 12 to 9, to 10, to 9, 8. It was gradually decreasing. That means that the COVID is leaving my body. I don't require that much oxygen.
And sir,
my oxygen levels were maintaining like around 90, 91, 92, which is a little low, but passable.
So you started feeling a little better. And how soon after that were you released?
After 10 days, I was released. But I was on oxygen. They sent oxygen home with me.
You were on oxygen till June.
I was on oxygen until 15th. June 15th. So that's from April 1st to June 15th.
Wow.
2.5 months almost.
And then you just started going back to work recently, correct?
24th of
June. Yeah. The 24th of June.
How's that been like?
Oh, it's not bad. Before I went to work, once I got off oxygen, I was walking around a track trying to build my strength and my lungs back up. It worked pretty good. So by the time I went back to work, it's no problem.
How did you feel about that experience? I mean, anybody would be super scared that this could be it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the first thing that crosses your mind is, suppose I don't make it. What's going to happen now?
When you're going around now, there's a whole big debate about wearing masks, not wearing masks, and stuff like that. How do you feel about that? Because you lived through this. Are you wearing a mask?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Every time I go out, I make sure I carry a mask with me.
It's not a debate for you.
Oh, it's not a debate. Not a debate whatsoever.
What do you tell?
Better be safe than sorry now.
Well, let me ask you this. I was in the harbor yesterday. I was on the East Chicago side. I didn't see a lot of mask wearers.
He was in the mill.
Until they catch it, they don't know. They won't realize it. You know, I suggest that everybody wear a mask, at least for their own safety, until this stuff blows over. But, I mean, I don't know how to tell you that. But.
Do you think there's been enough? Because East Chicago is highly has a lot of Hispanics, of course, and other lying issues with people with health concerns, diabetes, high blood pressure, hypertension. Then you've got the air quality issue in East Chicago with a lot of the factories. Do you feel like government, whether it be the city, state, or county, is doing enough to warn people in East Chicago about this pandemic?
They should advertise it more. Advise the people that it's not a joke. It's not a joke out there. If you catch this, it's very serious. It could damage you for life, or it could put you in the ground, you know.
How are you feeling right now? Have you feel like you're fully recovered, or are you still?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm just about back there. I'm about at 98, 97%, I'd say. Still get a little, I still need a breather every now and then if I climb up a bunch of stairs or something, do something physically exercise, you know. But other than that, I'm fine.
Have you made any lifestyle changes or anything like that?
Yeah, watch what I eat.
Taking medication.
Taking my medication the way it's supposed to be taken, yes.
All right. And your wife, how is she doing? Because she contracted this, but she wasn't hospitalized.
She's doing fine. I guess part of her medicine that she takes for her asthma was helping her out. It's the steroids and the prednisone, I guess, that was helping her out, because that's what they gave me in the hospital, along with that malaria medicine. Now, I don't know if that did any good, but I'm pretty sure the steroids helped me out.
You took hydroxyquil?
Yes, yes.
Oh, wow. So the medicine that the president's proposing, it actually helped you.
Yeah, I don't know if it did or not, because now they're saying that it...
There's symptoms behind.
Yeah, that it really doesn't work, but, you know, I can't say if it did or not, but...
Yeah.
I pulled out of it.
Well, your wife is sitting right there. How are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling all right. I mean, I'm having my issues with my asthma because the humidity's real high out here, and the breathing these fumes from the mills and all this other stuff. I mean, the air quality's horrible. So.
Do you think that just makes it worse for people in these kind of urban areas? That's why some of the rates are so high, that not only do you have underlying health conditions like diabetes and hypertension, but you got to deal with the pollution factor as well.
Yeah, I definitely believe that. But then again, you got an issue with somebody that's not taking it serious, which would be the mayor over here. Where he still had people riding 4 deep in trucks. I was riding next to 2 people in my garbage truck originally. I mean, you got to realize this is something serious. And people out here, there's a lot of people. You got to realize this is a low income area. Everything over here is low income or no income. So you know most of them people don't have money to begin with. So you know they're going to have underlying conditions because they're not taking care of their health properly already.
Well, let me ask you this, beyond just city employees, when you're going out in the stores, when you're going everywhere, do you feel just the general public is taking this serious enough in East Chicago?
No. There's like sometimes I'll see some people with masks, but like a couple weeks ago, I went to Speedway to get gas because I get gas instead of my husband, trying to keep him from even getting this before he even got it. And some lady was like a couple weeks ago, oh, that mask is cute, but she didn't have a single mask on. And they're looking at me like, what's wrong with her? And I'm thinking, you're not getting there. Even people of Valpo ain't getting it, man. We went to a restaurant, there's people sitting there laughing at us and looking at us like there's something wrong with us. And I was like, I don't know what she laughing at. What's something wrong with us? What do we look funny? And she heard me because I'm like, why would you have employees wear it, but you have customers subjecting people to catching it anyway. I mean, everybody should take this consideration into heart and say, I don't want it. Even if it's not me, it's about my family. Everybody's got elderly and children.
How did you manage to not get hospitalized with the COVID?
Like I told you, my husband said, I believe it's because I was already on. Before this kicked off real bad, I went to and seen a pulmonologist for my asthma, and I'm actually overdosing on it. I'm taking more than the normal person. So because I knew this was coming on, I use an inhaler machine with the nebula, 2 pumps a day. I'm on an inhaler at night, 2 pumps a day. So I'm overdosing on steroids to begin with. And I was already on prednisone to begin with before he got sick. So I like I said, I believe it hit me into my head because I had a headache from like March 20th until May 12th, a really bad headache. That's why I'm like, I don't even know why they worried about fever. Fever is the last thing they need to worry about. You ask somebody if they have a headache and you know it's not sinus infection, because sinus infection, your eyes run and stuff real bad. If you have a severe headache, you guarantee you got it. A fever? When my husband got admitted, he didn't have a fever. Not at all.
Oh, wow.
So this whole fever thing is ridiculous, running around with thermometers and stuff like that. Like, I ran a fever in the beginning. I was running a fever so bad, it felt like my head was going to blow off within the first week of me being sick. But after that passed, I mean, I got over the fever, and then I never got it again. But when he got admitted, he didn't have a fever.
Wow.
So you need to look and start stating the real situations to be looking for with people. You could consider a fever. You could check it. But that's not the thing. The first question should be, do you have a headache? Is your body aching?
You know, do you think maybe that because East Chicago is more lower income, that people just kind of tune all this stuff out? They may not even have money for masks and all that, so they don't worry about it.
Yeah. They should be literally handing masks out to people instead of food at pantries to me. You get with a food pantry, masks should be required to hand them out. If they don't have it, they should be required to be able to get some. That's for sure.
The state has these periodic free testing sites in East Chicago, but not all the time. Do you think the city needs a permanent free testing site from the state?
Yeah, they have a medical clinic right on Chicago Avenue. And there's no reason that they're not allowing somebody to go in there and to get tested for this stuff, to allow you to go in there. Because I went to 2 of the 3 East Chicago ones over here. I was tested. So, and that was just for me to know whether I had it or not, to know in case something else came out of it, what I was like in the beginning. I knew what to look forward to.
And that was Jose and Melinda Gutierrez of East Chicago talking about their battle with COVID-19. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
We have Brendan and Carrie here from Clancy's Public House out of Portage.
We got Chris here joining us from Gady's Chocolates and Ice Cream out of Lansing.
So we got we're going to have Nick from Albano's on from Valparaiso. And they just opened up a place maybe 6 months ago in the mall called the Pita Stop. It's very unique. We got the 18th Street Brewery in.
Let's eat with Chef Nick every Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. With East Chicago leading the region with the highest COVID-19 rate, I wanted to ask a city official why that is. Diana Garcia Burns is director of the East Chicago Health Department. I asked her, with more than 700 confirmed COVID-19 cases, making for a rate of 2.6%, is there more to the story?
Well, Mike, as you know, there's always more to the story. You know, we would, you know, hope our positivity rate would be a little lower, but considering our demographics and population, which is a majority of Hispanics and African American, and the disparities within our community, I think, you know, we're not doing too bad.
All right.
And I did look at, I'm sorry, you know, I did look at, after we briefly spoke, like South Bend, which kind of mirrors our community, and Elkhart, which kind of mirrors our community, and they too are at, you know, similar population, and they're actually, they're higher than we are. You know, Elkhart is at 2.5 and South Bend is at 2.09. So, but it, you know, pretty much the same with the similar demographics. So,
and how long have you, you're the health director for the East Chicago City Health Department?
Yes, sir, I am.
How long have you been in and around East Chicago?
I am from East Chicago. I graduated from the East Chicago school systems way, way back in the day. I'm not going to give my age, but those who know me, I've been here. I've been part of this community for a very, very long time.
You know, we've been seeing numbers nationally, closer to home in Chicago, where it does seem, in a number of studies, that Hispanics and African Americans do tend to get hit harder with this virus. What are some of the aspects in East Chicago that you think might contribute to why Hispanics and African Americans are contracting this virus at a higher rate than, say, white Americans?
So, you know, we have a population that's uninsured, underinsured, and, you know, many of the working poor now that, you know, don't even have insurance due to our current situation in our country, and not only in our country, in our nation, but, you know, it's health disparities, it's, you know, medical conditions and comorbidities that affect these two populations more. And a lot of times, you know, I was also the director of St. Catherine's Emergency Room in the past. People don't like to go to the doctor or really come to the emergency room. So they wait till they're really, really sick, and then they present, you know, to the doctor or to the emergency room for whatever reason. You know, a lot of times they're afraid, and a lot of times they don't want a bill. So it's all about us as a health department to get out there and educate our community and let them know there's resources out there for them. We have a federally qualified health center within the city of East Chicago called HealthLink that assists those individuals and help them get insurance via their navigators. We also have a look-alike right here in our building at 100 West Chicago Avenue, 219, and they're also able to assist the underinsured and uninsured. So we do have resources here. We have to just make sure that our community population knows that those resources are available.
You know, Indiana now is under a mask mandate. Are you seeing enough folks in East Chicago wearing a mask?
Well, Mike, I am proud to say that East Chicago was the first. Our city council passed the ordinance on June 8th that was signed, and we were pushing that ordinance June 8th, followed by Lake County, which was just a couple of weeks ago, and then the state. So we have been pushing the mask up, you know, campaign since the beginning of June.
All right. And is there anything more the city or government in general can do to, you know, just try to get some of those numbers down? Because we're starting to see surges in other parts of Indiana and in Chicagoland area. With the demographics that you mentioned and you talked about in East Chicago, to try to, I guess, lower that rate, are there things you think the city can still do more to just try to address the rate issue?
Yes, you know, we look at gatherings and, you know, funerals and church hosting events and all those type of things. And I think it's important as government in general that we maybe need to back up a little bit. As the numbers trend up, we probably need to back up. We don't want people losing their businesses because they have to shut down, but we have to be smart about what we're doing. So that's why it's important for us to get out there and make sure that there's not large gatherings and that we're out there educating and, you know, we're making sure people mask up as they're growing in businesses. You know, we're not trying to isolate people from each other, but we want them to be safe. And the only way to do that is to educate them on the importance of wearing a mask and social distancing and not gathering in large groups. So that's our job. You know, if our numbers tend to, if they trend upward, then of course we'll be looking at what do we need to do differently as a health department. So, you know, every day we look at our numbers, we look at our deaths. Thank God, you know, pretty much we're flat with our deaths. Our numbers are trending upward, but we have more testing sites also. That doesn't excuse the numbers going up because you want people to be negative. But as people tend to gather and more things open, then, you know, they lose that initiative to stay distanced. So that's, you know, our job to go out there and say, you know, remember that we don't want large groups, large gatherings. You must mask, wash your hands, stay safe.
Let me ask you this, with a large amount of Latinos in East Chicago, many of them probably primarily Spanish-speaking, is there enough bilingual resources to get the message out for folks who may not be proficient in English?
Correct. Well, we have bilingual staff here at the health department, which is a plus. So we do try and get our stuff out in English and Spanish. And in the event that we're out and, you know, and we know that we're going into an area that's predominantly Spanish-speaking, then we make sure that we take a Spanish-speaking employee with us.
But do you think, not just in terms from the city, but you think overall that they're getting the message to mask up, social distance, don't be in large gatherings? Hispanics tend to like to, I'm Hispanic, like to have bigger gatherings and parties and maybe not, you know, adhere to some of those warnings of not doing that.
No, you're absolutely right. But I think what has happened as I have gone to several businesses that would host different, you know, like quinceañeras and things like that, they're also worried about having large groups. So as I was taking the ordinance out back in June, you know, they were asking. Matter of fact, I got a couple of calls and said, Ms. Burns, you know, we want to do this. Can you come over and look at my space to tell me how many, you know, people I can potentially have? So I think people are becoming more aware. You know, it's all over the media, but I think they're more aware, and I think, you know, it's hitting some people closer to home because they've had loved ones that, you know, have come down with the virus that, thank God, have made it through, but were very, very ill from it.
Any final thoughts, Director?
Well, I just, you know, like to say that I think, you know, the city, the mayor, and, you know, Dr. Browning, who's our health officer, and myself, and the employees of the city of Chicago, we have all actually, you know, bound together to try and get this message out to our community. We work as a team. It doesn't matter, you know, which department we're in, but we're out there trying to promote, you know, a safe environment for our community. And, you know, you can only appreciate that when you have people, you know, on your team that are out there, you know, speaking the same language.
And that was Diana Garcia Burns, director of the East Chicago Health Department. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Action, adventure, thriller, drama, horror, and comedy are all examples of movie genres, but also video games. There's a video game for all types of movie genre, no matter how niche, with Ghost of Tsushima out now with an Akira Kurosawa mode honoring the famed samurai movie director. We here at Region Nerd Alert think of other video games that remind us of some great movie genres or directors. Come nerd out on the next Region Nerd Alert this Saturday at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. When I say state line slaughterhouse, do you know what that's referring to? What if I told you that's an early name to the city of Hammond? Well, it is, and that's not all. Did you also know that Germans came here by the droves in the 1840s? A 19th century historian named Alfred Andreas described the city as, quote, an unbroken forest of heavy timber, but which also has long since disappeared under the aggressive civilization of the white man's axe. That's a passage from the new 204-page book called Lost Hammond, Indiana, published by the History Press based in Charleston, South Carolina. The author is Joseph S. Pete, award-winning reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Joseph, welcome to Off Mic here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
Thank you. Joseph, the first question I have for you, and it's probably going to be pretty tough for you to answer, and I don't mean to stump you, but that we often see your byline in the Times. You often have two, three, sometimes four stories in one day. How did you find time to write this book?
Oh, well, I write my day and I write by later at night. I do cover a wide array of beats for the Times, a lot of the business and art stuff, but after a long day of writing, I like to unwind by going home and writing more. So I just worked on it in evenings, mostly evenings over the course of about a year. I spent a lot of the research at Indiana University Northwest's Calumet Regional Archives and at the Susan Long local history room at the Hammond Public Library. They're open on the evenings on Wednesdays, and I was there pretty much every Wednesday for a while, doing research and scanning a lot of the photos that were involved in the book. It has nearly 94 historic black and white photos, ranging from dramatic shots of like early ice harvests at Wolf Lake to more contemporary shots of more contemporary shots. But a lot of the history is documented through the photos in the book as well.
Well, let me ask you, Joseph, where did you, first of all, how long did it take you to write this book?
Oh, it was about a year. It was roughly about a year. I've always had an interest in writing. I was born in Hammond at St. Margaret's. I grew up like in Highland, just outside the city, often spent a lot of time there as a kid. We went to the Hammond Civic Center a lot for like the boxing, I'd walk to Woodmore Mall. Frequented the bookstore there quite a bit. Spent a lot of time in the city, Wolf Lake, hiking around there. And I've always had an interest in, I'm a journalist by day, but my long-term interest has always kind of been in writing books. And I've particularly been interested in writing about Northwest Indiana and its history. I just feel like we're a very storied, historic place that often kind of gets overlooked. We're a no man's land between Chicago and Indiana. We're not really fully accepted or embraced by either. But there's just a ton of rich history here. You've had a lot of prominent historic figures, who come through the area, Gene Shepard, Scholl, Orville Redenbacher, Alva Roebuck, and we've had a great impact on society. Octave Chanute helped invent flight here. The steel we've made at our mills, it's gone to build, countless cars and washing machines, countless bridges, a lot of the notable architecture of the 20th century, the Sears Tower, the St. Louis Arch, Touchdown Jesus at Notre Dame, all built with either Regent Steel or Regent Know-How, the John Hancock Center, the Houston Astrodome. The region has just had a huge impact on our nation, but it often doesn't get its full appreciation and due. And I've just had an interest about writing books about the region and kind of telling its story.
Well, that's true. It doesn't get its due. But let me ask you this. What was that impetus, though? And obviously, you take a lot of notes. You cover a lot of things throughout Northwest Indiana. And you said you were born in Hammond. What was that sort of the epiphany where you said, you know what, I need to write a book on all this?
Oh, I was initially approached. I was pitched by the History Press about potentially writing a book. They had seen some of my journalism. And they do this law series where there's a series of another local journalist, Jerry Davich, you're obviously familiar with. He wrote Lost Gary a couple years ago. But they've done lost books about kind of bygone or faded institutions from across the from cities and communities across the country. I wanted to celebrate Hammond's history in this book, though. I also wanted to take great pains as to not just make it kind of a, strictly about faded or bygone institutions, especially in the Rust Belt and not just in Northwest Indiana, but in, Ohio and Western Pennsylvania and all these areas. Buffalo, you see a lot of the romanticization of like what was, and the areas kind of get depicted as now like economically depressed wastelands or whatever. And that's not the reality of it. Hammond has certainly evolved and changed over time, but it's by no means like, a husk of its former self or anything. It's still a very lively, vibrant community. And I tried to take pains in the book to kind of present that and show that, Hammond is not just all history. It's still, it still has a future, it's a bright future, and it's still, there's still quite a bit there today.
That's right.
Even
that's
if, right. As a society, we've moved on from a lot of the stuff I write about in the book. Like, you don't have grand downtown department stores really in mid-sized cities or much anywhere anymore. You don't have grand movie palaces. They've been replaced by the multiplex. Our kind of entire way of life as a society has changed since what some may perceive as like Hammond's heyday or whatever.
That's right. There is a lot of history to Hammond, but I mean, right off the bat, you find out that the first name of the city was basically known as State Line Slaughterhouse, because as you say in the book, there really wasn't much into Hammond at that point. Why don't you tell us, what was Hammond like in those early years? And we're talking about 1840s or even earlier than that.
Yes. Yeah, it was very rough in those early times. It basically, like, the slaughterhouses in the south side of Chicago were a big industry. And like the steel industry would later do, it basically spilled over from Chicago. They ran out of land. It spilled over into Northwest Indiana. They built George Hammond, an industrialist from Detroit. He ended up building a huge slaughterhouse on basically the state line. It was named State Line Slaughterhouse. That was originally the city's name and what it was known as. That's what the post office was named. That's what the rail yard was named. It was, he tried to make the operations kind of seem impermanent to kind of cheat the railroads out of charging them like too much freight. But originally it was just very rough and tumble. It was pretty much all men who came to work in the slaughterhouse jobs, which were very, dirty and, if they had wives, they would stay in hotels in Chicago. But like for entertainment, the workers, they would have fist fighting, dog fighting, things of that nature. It was just a very like almost Wild West like atmosphere. And it was not the most environmentally friendly business either. You actually had the Grand Calumet River caught on fire the way the Cuyahoga River infamously did in Cleveland, because so much animal fat had spilled into the river that it ended up catching fire at one point.
Well, let me ask you this, Joseph, and I don't know if you have the answer to this or not, but did basically State Line Slaughterhouse, which would become Hammond later on, did it just grow out because they just lost space in Chicago to do more of slaughtering of cattle?
Well, they was looking to build another operation. They were pretty full to capacity. And it ended up, they were scouting for land, and I think they found cheaper land, and it was just a occupation here. And it was one of those, like, you've seen this pattern over and over again in Northwest Indiana. as with U.S. Steel and Albert Gary and with John Rockefeller and Standard Oil. George Hammond pretty much spent his entire career in Detroit, and he got rich off of his business operation in Hammond. And a lot of that money went, he built like the first skyscraper in Detroit. He was one of the original founders of the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is still a very fine cultural institution. But he kind of profited quite a bit off of his operation here until it eventually burned down. He later built a second slaughterhouse in Nebraska, kind of closer to where the cattle are actually raised.
Yeah, you know,
and it was a big operation though, because it was at the time it was the main serving the East Coast with meat. Like a lot of the meat that they processed here, it was sent to the kind of the Boston area. And his big innovation that made it such a large operation was he figured out how to refrigerate meat in a train car, which at the time was help preserve it, because at the time it was very difficult to send it that far. They either had to cure it or they had to, or it wasn't always of the best quality when it got off the train. But he figured out how to, preserve the meat via refrigeration over the several days journey out to the New England area.
You know, it's funny because the city of Hammond has a similar history to Gary in that they're both named after people who didn't really spend a lot of time here. You got Albert H. Gary, who obviously the chairman of the U.S. Steel, set up his steel company here in Gary. And then you have George Hammond, who probably better known for building up Detroit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's our area has been so shaped by industrialists and heavy industry, and just a lot of them were never, barely had a toe in the community. They weren't really invested in it in any kind of personal way. It was just a business operation for them. But our area has been defined by, you know, its steel mills and its oil refineries and its institutions. And the book delves into a lot of that. It delves into a lot of the bygone factory operations that Hammond had. W.B. Conkey plant, it was once made most of the books in the country, were once manufactured for a long time in Hammond. The Indiana Botanical Society was a huge herbalist thing that distributed herbs all over the world. You had player pianos that were produced here, chains. All Hammond produced so many different products, you know, tanks during the war, train cars. It never had like the giant steel mills like Gary or East Chicago or, you know, Portage, but it did, it did have a wide array of industry that did contribute quite a bit to the nation.
Well, let me ask you this. The book is called Lost Hammond, Indiana. It's written by award-winning Northwest Indiana Times reporter Joseph S. Pete. Now, let's talk about some of the things that I found really interesting. Things that have been lost that aren't there anymore. Things that, you know, people may not have, first of all, the one thing I do find interesting, you alluded to, is that we think about the Great Chicago Fire, but you had sort of the Great Hammond Fire that, for all intents and purposes, actually knocked out what you were saying, George Hammond and his big time cattle operation. But that's not the only thing. There's a lot of things that got lost in other big fires in Hammond in the early 19th century, or the early 20th century.
Oh, absolutely. That was not uncommon at the time, too. It was very difficult for fire departments to operate. They didn't have the infrastructure they have now. They're, you know, using pretty primitive means to put out fires, but the slaughterhouse did burn down. And at the time, it seemed like the end of the world to Hammond, because it destroyed, you know, most of the city at the time was like limited housing. The Hessville area was being settled separately, but the area, you know, it was a lot of housing and everything was pretty much built up around the factory. But the city had started to grow to the point at that point where the W.B. Conkey plant was already, you know, close to opening. And, they had, the economy was beginning to finally diversify where it wasn't just kind of a one slaughterhouse town. And so the plant was unfortunately never rebuilt. But honestly, that probably ended up being beneficial, because slaughterhouses, you know, there was a reason it was built in the middle of nowhere. Because, you know, they're very noxious fumes. There's a lot of emissions, spills into the water. For quality of life reasons, it probably helped Hammond's growth, actually, that it did it burn down, because, you know, people don't want to live right next to a giant slaughterhouse. It's just, an unpleasant neighbor, I guess.
One of the things that I had never heard of, and I'm hope I'm pronouncing it right, the Athay Hydro Amusement Park.
Oh yes, that was one of the big attractions. Five Points almost used to be kind of the center of the universe. They used to have multiple attractions and theme parks and roller coasters there by, and of course the Fish Palaces, Phil Schmidt's and Vogel's. And it was just like the center for dining and entertainment in the area. The Athay was very short lived, but it was very memorable because they were trying to put a kind of water attractions on Wolf Lake to kind of draw visitors in. And it ended up backfiring because the people were kind of besieged by mosquitoes. So what I thought, what a really amusing anecdote from the book in there is the owners tried to remedy this by going over to the Standard Oil refinery. And keep in mind, this was in the early 20th century. And there were very lax environmental laws at the time, but they got barrels of gasoline and then poured it into the lake to try to suppress the mosquitoes. And but their business just plan didn't end up working out. They weren't able to consistently draw people and ended up kind of shortly going out of business. But you had a lot of attractions there back in the day, like the Hammond Beach Inn. And there was the longest wooden roller coaster in the world was there. At the Five Points intersection. It was a huge hub.
Well, Joseph Peet is a writer, reporter, award-winning writer, reporter for the Northwest Indiana Times. He's the author of Lost Hammond, Indiana. And Joseph, thank you so much for being here on Off Mic.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
We have Brendan and Carrie here from Clancy's Public House out of Portage. We got Chris here joining us from Gady's Chocolates and Ice Cream out of Lansing. So we're going to have Nick from Albano's on from Valparaiso. And they just opened up a place maybe 6 months ago in the mall called the Pita Stop. It's very unique. We got the 18th Street Brewery in.
Let's eat with Chef Nick every Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. A week ago, baseball started its season after a long delay because of COVID-19. But already, we're seeing signs that getting this season completed will be a major challenge. Several teams and players and coaches have tested positive for the virus. A number of ball games have already been postponed. Joining us to talk about the latest is veteran sports reporter Cheryl Ray Stout of WBEZ. Welcome to Off Mic, Cheryl.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, Cheryl, are we going to see any more Major League Baseball games this season?
I think they're going to continue to try, but with the St. Louis Cardinals announcing today they have positive tests and canceling their game with Milwaukee, it's going to be difficult, very difficult.
I know you're covering the games and they're playing, but are you already hearing rumblings that this is just not going to be able to go forward?
No, not yet. MLB is trying their darndest to get this thing continued. They're going to have to make up a lot of games. In fact, what they're going to do with double headers, instead of being 9 innings, each game will be 7 innings of a double header. So they're trying to make these changes. And Michael, almost every day there's something new, something different, and it's just a wait and see.
Right. And we know earlier in the week, Rick Renteria, the manager of the White Sox, had a test. People thought maybe he had COVID. It came back negative. But it's got to be nerve-wracking for both the White Sox and the Cubs and traveling. I mean, they're trying to put on a good show and a good game, but this got to be really nerve-wracking for them.
Michael, we've asked the players and the managers about that, and yes, you are absolutely right. It's very stressful, especially once they went on the road. Now, they all said that the hotels have done a good job of sanitizing. The players are staying in their rooms. They're not, going out to any place where they're at. But it's still very difficult because they're thinking about that. They have to take these tests, and then they have to wait for the results. And fans may think, well, what's the big deal? Well, they don't know if they get it until they get those test results. And that's what's really weighing on their mind, besides going to the park and playing the game.
And now, a lot of these players or coaches who have been contracting COVID-19, a lot of them just aren't asymptomatic. Some of them have been dealing with some of these symptoms, correct?
Correct. The thing with Ricky Renteria, he woke up with a sore throat and you know, his nose issues. So he did it to be precautionary. It's not like he knew he had it. But everybody knows that at any time a symptom can come on or not, there won't be a symptom, and you could test positive.
But how do the teams get the results back so fast?
Well, they did set up a second lab. They had one lab in Utah. They set up a second one at Rutgers on the East Coast. So they are turning them around much quicker than they had been during the workout session. So that's going to help them. You know, you look at the NBA, the WNBA, and the NHL, zero positive cases because of the bubble. Baseball has that issue because of the travel, and that's where it's going to be hard every day.
And now you were talking about the NBA. It looks like they got started with their season this week or yesterday. How's it going so far for them?
Well, as I said, they had zero tests. They were able to get, they have the first couple games, you know, and so it was, you know, they did a good job of it. They've been very good about the social justice situation with Black Lives Matter on the court, on their shirts. They all kneeled for the national anthem. It's a very unified setting. And the fact is they know, and it's a smaller number of people that is involved with this appeared as a, when you compare it to baseball. So that's why they're able to be prudent about having it. And it was exciting watching the Lakers play the Clippers last night, and LeBron James gets the game-winning shot at the end.
Right. And the NHL, we know they are starting up their games again, but in Canada, mm-hmm. in a sort of similar bubble. How are our Blackhawks doing so far with this situation?
Well, the best news, Michael, was having Corey Crawford come back last Saturday. I was at that practice when he was there. He did play the exhibition game on Wednesday for half a game. So he's expected to start. That's a big deal for him because he was pretty weakened. He had a lot of the symptoms. So he was weakened by it, but he's making a comeback. It's going to be interesting because it's a best-of-five-game series against the Oilers in Edmonton, no less. But the fact that there's no crowd there, it's a neutral site.
You know, I'm wondering if Major League Baseball should have just maybe thought about creating smaller bubbles in Canada. I don't even know if Canada would have allowed it, but it seems like they have lesser problems with COVID-19 than the United States. And maybe, you know, splitting the games up between Montreal and Toronto, maybe Calgary, maybe they could have done this on the north of the border.
But the fact is the Toronto Blue Jays cannot even play their games
right.
in Canada. So you're right, if they had a safe place to go, but there is no safe place. And there's way too many people, way too many teams, and way too many games. Because the fact is with the NHL, it's smaller, it's more confined, there's less players because they don't have as many teams. Whereas baseball has more issues with players, trainers, coaches. And, you know, and that's why it wasn't going to be safe.
All right, Cheryl E. Stout is a veteran sports reporter with WBEZ. You can catch all her reporting on that station. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us here again on Off Mic.
You're welcome, Michael.
And that's going to do it for today's show. I'd like to thank my guests like Cheryl Ray Stout, and we had earlier guests early in the show, and all the producers here on Lakeshore Public Radio for Off Mic. So for me, Michael Puente, and all of us here at Lakeshore Public Radio, have a great weekend.